Welcome back to Podcast Recovery. I am your host, Eric V. David O. will not be able to attend this evening. He had to work, which, you know, I have a certain level of feelings towards that. But today, we are joined by Dirk C. How are you doing today, Dirk?
I'm excellent, Eric. Thanks. How are you?
Good. Good. And where are you calling in from today?
I live in Bourbonnais, Illinois, which is pretty much about an hour straight south of downtown Chicago.
Nice, nice. I lived in Chicago for a year. It was a great city.
It is a great city.
And how long have you, when were you first introduced to recovery?
Actually, I put myself into treatment this past October 15th. Rosecrans in Champaign, Illinois was my first exposure to treatment.
Awesome. And what is your sobriety date?
October 13th. So 2 days after my sobriety date, I was in treatment. And it was amazing. You know, there's no two ways about that. It was 3 weeks, 21 days on the head that I spent there, and probably would have stayed another week had not Blue Cross Blue Shield told me that I was healed. It was a life-changing 3 weeks, without a doubt. You know, it was a very difficult 3 weeks in a lot of ways. It might have been the toughest 3 weeks of my life, but it was also the best.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, with all that out of the way, I'll turn it over to you to share your experience, strength, and hope with us. So take it away.
Where would you like me to start?
Start from wherever you would like to begin. So you can start from the beginning, or you can start halfway. So whatever you feel comfortable with.
Yeah. I guess I attribute some of my alcoholism in part to my childhood. I was raised in the home of an alcoholic, abusive alcoholic father. He never laid a hand on my brother or myself, but was frequently abusive to my mom when he was drinking, you know, verbally, mentally, physically, emotionally, basically every way you could be. I was born in the mid 60s and raised, you know, primarily through the mid 70s. And, my dad was a very, very hardworking guy. He was a truck driver, got up very early in the morning and worked, you know, a lot of hours. But, the weekends were terror filled in my house. You know, he frequently would come home with a 12 pack and he was going to drink them all. And, the arguing would start, and it was a very tough way to be raised, I guess. It was just my brother and I and my mom. I was 4 years older than my brother, so I found myself at an early age in a role of responsibility that I didn't really want, nor was I prepared for. I frequently found myself trying to protect my brother and my mom as best I could. You know, even at a young age, we lived in a very small house at that time. And, you know, once the arguing started, it was impossible to miss. I mean, I remember, you know, my brother and I shared a bedroom. We had bunk beds, and we would lay in the bottom bunk when they were fighting and just, you know, under the covers together, but freezing and shaking because we were so afraid. And that was constant. You know, that was for the first 15 years of my life. So looking back on it today at 55, I've come to realize that the primary emotions of my childhood were fear and anxiety. I wish that it wasn't that way. And, you know, but the fact is that it was. And then Monday mornings would come and I'd have to put the face on and go to school like everybody else and, you know, act like everything was okay. And one thing that's different about that time growing up as opposed to today is that, counseling and shelters and help for families going through that were not very prevalent. And, I kept a lot of stuff inside. You know, like I said, you go to school Monday morning and you're not going to tell your friends what happened in your house over the weekend. You know, I felt there were a lot of emotions that I obviously dealt with. I became resentful. I was obviously resentful at my dad for what he was putting our family through. You know, there were times where I was resentful at my mom for not taking my brother and myself and leaving. You know, that point of enough is enough never really came. And, you know, so we went through a lot, endured a lot. You know, I can remember very vividly on Friday afternoons, even it was in the summer when everybody's out playing, I would find a way to be in my bedroom when my dad got home from work, because I could look out the window and watch him come out of the garage, and I could tell whether he had a 6-pack or a 12-pack under his arm, just by the size of the bag. And, you know, a 6-pack wasn't too bad. A 12-pack was, you know, it kind of made water run through my stomach, because I knew it was going to be a long night. And, you know, that was pretty constant for the first 15 years of my life. You know, thankfully he quit. You know, when I was 15, he quit. He found AA, and I don't really recall, you know, now that I'm in AA myself, I don't really recall a lot of the details about his involvement, but, you know, I do know that it was a game changer for him. And I think, you know, kind of like when I quit myself 4 months ago, the people around you are excited for you, but they're also, you know, kind of watching for a relapse or whatever. And I can remember being excited that he quit drinking, because it was bringing an end to a lot of terror. But, you know, to his credit, and I think I have more appreciation for that now, having gone through it myself, I mean, he never drank again. And, you know, also thankfully the relationship that we really didn't have at that time, you know, when I was an adult and was married with kids, he was, you know, he and I were able to have a great relationship. He had a great relationship with my daughters. He loved them like nobody's business. So, you know, the last 13, 15 years of his life was, you know, as it should have been. But, you know, it obviously had a huge impact on me, you know, living through that. You know, also kind of around that time in high school, I was dating a girl who was bulimic. She had an eating disorder, and, you know, nobody really knew that about her, and I did. So, you know, I look back, and there was a lot of things I was carrying on my plate that I wasn't ready to be carrying. And, you know, for a while I thought, you know, even as an adult, I thought that I had kind of got through that part of my life unscathed, but that's far from true. You know, oddly enough, about the time that my dad's drinking stopped, my drinking started. You know, in high school, I went to high school from 1980 to 1983, and, you know, I look back at the 80s, and I was just talking to a friend about this the other day, and the 80s were a very wild time. You know, it was a great decade. I mean, great music, and, you know, a lot of good things came out of the 80s, but it was, you know, I grew up in a very small town in northern Illinois, a town of about 3,000. It was rural. You know, back in that time, the DUIs were not, a DUI was very, very rare. And, you know, when you lived in a small town, everybody knew everybody. That included the police. And, you know, you didn't really worry about drinking and driving and the things that we did. But I started drinking when I was a freshman in high school. You know, I remember I didn't play football because I was built like a pencil, but, you know, Friday night home football games were a big party night for people who weren't involved. And, you know, that started my freshman year, and, you know, drinking some beers here and there, peppermint schnapps at a football game because it was cold or, you know, whatever. But during my high school, those 4 years of high school, I mean, I was an athlete, and that was, being an athlete was a lifesaver for me, because even through my youth, you know, the chaos that was going in my home, I found refuge in playing sports. And, you know, there was nothing more important to me than baseball at the time. And, you know, and that carried on through my high school career. And I didn't drink during seasons, but, you know, in between seasons or in the summertime, it was on. And, you know, I remember I just remember clearly a memory of three of my friends pulling up in front of my house my senior year in high school, and the summer right after I graduated, and had three cases of beer in the car, and we drove around all day and all night until they were gone, drinking and driving. You know, drinking it before dances at school, drinking at party. You know, there were a lot of house parties back then, and yeah, I can't say that, you know, as an alcoholic back then necessarily, but I do know that back then I was drinking to run from the demons that grew out of my household. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know it at that time. You know, at that time, you know, all my friends were doing it. Everybody seemed to be doing it. There was nothing really that stood out as abnormal about my drinking. You know, I was able to get a baseball scholarship to St. Xavier College in Chicago. So the rural kid went off to the big city at 18, and, you know, I've always been able to make friends pretty easily, and did so there, and before I knew it, I was getting into bars in Chicago at 18, because guys on my baseball team knew bouncers, and, you know, it figured out how good Heineken was, and, you know, I mean, I was having a blast, and again, it didn't really strike me as problematic. 1985, I had to give up my baseball scholarship because my dad, you know, in addition to being an alcoholic, and he was sober at this time, but he was also a bipolar manic depressive.
Ooh.
And it's bad. That's a bad combination.
Yeah.
You know, and he had been drinking for a long time in that condition, but, you know, at that time, my sophomore year in college ended, and the medications for a manic depressive are absolutely crucial, and his were completely out of whack. His behavior was off the wall. My mom and my brother were, again, going through things that were, you know, completely reminiscent of our childhood, and even though Chicago was not very far away from where I lived, you know, I made the decision to go home and be with them and help. And, you know, I did that willingly, but, you know, giving up my dream of playing college baseball brought with it some anger and some more resentment. And, you know, I transferred out to a local university, a big school. You know, where I played baseball in Chicago was a very small school. It was 3,000. And I transferred out to Northern Illinois University, which was probably 25,000. Lived at home and, you know, commuted, and, you know, back then the mid-80s was the true era of the real happy hour, you know, Thursday, mm-hmm. Friday, Saturday, two for ones and free food in bars, and I found myself there all the time. You know, I worked in a bookstore on campus at NIU, and, you know, like I said, I was angry at coming home, but that was my own decision, and, you know, I was resentful and found myself drinking a lot at that point when I had transferred out there. In fact, I remember during that time, you know, when all your friends come home from college, wherever they were at, a bunch of us were out 13 nights in a row until 2 a.m. over Christmas break, And that was the first time I remember waking up the morning on that 14th day and went to work at the bookstore, and I was shaking. You know, my hands were shaking. That was the only time in my life that I've ever had, you know, the shakes, the jitters, whatever you want to call them. But again, I was running from things. You know, that alcohol took me away from the reality that I didn't want to live. And, you know, I think part of what I've realized, having gone through treatment and, you know, the last 4 months is I generally associated drinking with fun. You know, it symbolized fun to me. It symbolized stress-free. It symbolized being able to relax. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, I was creating a pattern that would continue. And, you know, it did. I got hired in 1988 as an English teacher at the high school that I graduated from, which was pretty cool. But on Thursday nights, I was still running back to DeKalb and hanging out on campus with, you know, at the same bars, the same people. And I was taking a lot of Fridays off of work. And, you know, it just, the partying continued. And Fridays, Fridays at 3:30, it was, you know, standing time. We met at this local VFW, all these coaches. I mean, coaches that coached me when I was in high school, because I was only 23 years old when I started teaching. And, you know, it was very cool to hang out with, you know, to hang out with teachers and coaches that taught and coached you. But we were drinking all the time. You know, and those Fridays would start at 3:30 and they might end at 3:30 a.m. for me, you know, with, you know, find a buddy or whatever. So, you know, saying that out loud just reminds me that, you know, my big problem has always been when I have the first one, God knows how many are going to follow. And, you know, I got married in 1990. My daughters were born in 93 and 96. And, you know, I was teaching and coaching and running a painting business at the same time, making money. I was doing all this stuff. But the drinking continued. You know, it wasn't, my alcoholism was never, you know, where I'd come home at the end of a day or night and just start pounding. I mean, that wasn't me. It was just my big issue was in certain social situations where I could have as many as I wanted that I did, you know. So there were, you know, my married life, there were a lot of bad incidents following wedding receptions and parties and, you know, where I just couldn't stop. And, you know, it seemed like in my younger days, there was a lot of anger that came out of me when I was drunk, which I regret. But, you know, ultimately I got divorced in 2014. And, you know, during a year that I was separated, I was living with a friend, my best friend, who was also going through a divorce. And for that year, we were pretty much drunk the entire year. I mean, I was working one job, he was working another, but there was a Buffalo Wild Wings about 300 yards from his place, and we would meet there. And, you know, I look back at that year, and it was, you know, it was a mess. You know, I was out of my house, I was away from my kids, I was looking for a job, and, you know, all that stuff just piled up. But he and I, you know, we used to tell the bartender at B-Dubs, you know, you keep them coming until you get nervous and then give us two more. I mean, it would be, you know, just until whenever. And so that, you know, I think that's when things really started to get out of hand with me. You know, I did find a job and then I got back into education the following year. But it was a job that I wasn't really happy with and found myself, you know, it was an hour drive for me to and from work from my house. And, you know, being a high school athletic director, which I was at that time, you work a lot of hours. And, you know, I would leave Rockford and I'd find a way to a Fridays or a B-Dubs or you name it. And, you know, I'd drink before I went home. And then when I got home, I'd drink some more. And, you know, just constantly running from things that I should have been dealing with, but dealing with them through alcohol. You know, and then in 2017, I got a good job here in Bourbonnais as the athletic director here at the high school, and, you know, was making very good money. And, you know, it was a tough job. I was, you know, in charge of 27 sports, 150 coaches, and that's a lot of stress day in, day out. And, you know, even though I was that busy, I would find time to, you know, drink, whether it was when I got home or, you know, it didn't matter to me. If I had a great day, I could drink to celebrate it. If I had a bad day, I could drink to hope that tomorrow's better. If I had a so-so day, I could drink in hopes that tomorrow's a six instead of a five. You know, the alcoholic mind is interesting how it, you know, justifies things. But, you know, October 9th of last year, we had an open house, you know, like every school does, and about 15 or 20 of us went out afterwards. And for about 3.5 hours, I was one 16-ounce draft after another. And, you know, it's a Wednesday night, and I had to work the next day and got outside and realized I was in no condition to drive and navigated my car over to a woman's vehicle that, you know, a woman I had known who teaches there for 3 years, had no problem with, no nothing, and said something about jumping in to get a ride, and she filed a sexual harassment suit against me. And, you know, at that point, that was certainly not in my heart and not my intent. I was looking for a ride home. And 6 days later, I put myself in treatment. And, you know, obviously an incident like that wakes you up. But, you know, with Kathy, my girlfriend, it had been a constant pattern with her as well, you know, that I put her through a lot of things. And, you know, I just, that following morning when I found out that you know, a suit had been filed. I just, that was my rock bottom. You know, that was it for me. And I waited a few days, and I actually read the big book over the weekend before I put myself into treatment. But, you know, I made the decision to put myself in inpatient. You know, obviously I was not court ordered. I was not forced in any way to do that. But I knew in my heart that I needed inpatient. You know, outpatient wasn't going to work for me. I couldn't see somebody for an hour once a week and, you know, make progress. Mm-hmm. I needed to be, you know, I needed a period of time where I could just focus on myself, because one of my greatest faults is I always put other people's welfare ahead of my own. You know, from, like I've told you, a very young age, I was always concerned about my mom and brother, and, you know, just kind of grew up worrying more about other people than I did myself. But I knew that I needed to be around other people, that when I, you know, when I said, when I have my first beer, I can't stop, that they understood what I was talking about. And, you know, I remember driving, Champaign's about an hour and 10 minutes south of where I live here. And I remember driving down there that day to put myself in. And I was scared, you know, because I didn't know what to expect. But I was also very much eyes wide open that, you know, kind of because I was putting myself in there, I had made my mind up that I was going to get every ounce out of Rosecrans that I could get, you know, whatever they were selling, I was going to be buying. And I did, you know, for 3 weeks, the 3 weeks that I was in there with, you know, always with 15 other guys, and those guys changed, you know, some came and went, you know, some left, some were coming in, it didn't matter, but we were all the same, and I needed that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of them were drug addicts, some of them were alcoholics, you know, it didn't matter, because we were all the same, we were all fighting the same demons. So it was a life-changing experience for me. I mean, I did. I soaked up every ounce of treatment I could get. And in fact, a lot of times in the evening, they'd give us TV time after 9 o'clock, and I would just go in my room and read the big book. You know, instead of watching TV and wasting an hour, I would try to get as much out of it as I could. And, you know, there was a point about halfway through my treatment that, you know, we had a lot of AA meetings and treatment. I think I went to 27 meetings in 21 days that I was there. And a lot of them we would have just on the unit with just us 16 guys. And those were always the best. And I remember one night at a meeting, I was talking about how I was trying to surrender, you know, my life over the will and care of God, because he is my higher power. And I remember saying exactly, I was about 85% there. And I've always been the person that, you know, I guess for an example, felt like my hands were always on the steering wheel of my life, that I would decide where I was going and what happened. But there was also always a part of me that wanted to completely give it up to God, because I always went to church. You know, I was raised Catholic. Kathy and I went to Willow Creek, which is an amazing, very large church in the suburbs of Chicago, which was an amazing experience. And you see people, I would see people, you know, during worship music time with both hands in the air and eyes closed. And I'd look at them, I'd say, man, they've 100% given their life up to him. And I always admired that. You know, I never looked at him funny. I just always looked at him and thought, I wish I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that night when I said that, one of the guys that I was on the floor with, he left the room that we were in, and I continued talking, and he came back in, and he had this envelope. And he called it, you know, it was a big square ornate envelope that you might find at a Hallmark store. And it was sealed, but on the back of it, there was a slit in it. And he gave it to me, like, in front of everybody. And he said, this is my higher power envelope, and I'm going to give this to you, because he was leaving the next day. Excuse me. So the point of the higher power envelope was you write down on a piece of paper all of the things you want to get off of you, mentally, physically, off your soul, and you're giving them to God by putting that piece of paper in that envelope. And I thought it was one of the most, you know, amazing things I'd ever heard. So he gave me that envelope, which I was touched by, and, you know, he and I were pretty close. And that night I went back into my room and I wrote a bunch of things down on paper. I just tore, you know, shreds of paper off, and I wrote things down from my childhood, from my past, from, you know, anything that I wanted to get off of me. And I put them in that envelope that night. And I woke up the next morning and I felt amazing. I had never felt like that before. So I knew at that point that I had surrendered. And I've continued to do so. You know, I think anybody who is working the program of AA knows the third step and knows how critical it is to really completely surrender. You know, you have to do step one perfectly. You have to admit that you're an alcoholic and that your life's unmanageable. That you can't waver on that, which I haven't. But step three to me was just as critical. And that night when I was, you know, just the simple symbolism of writing things down on a piece of paper and putting them on him was very powerful for me. And from that point on, you know, it's been, you know, it's been really, really good. And, you know, I walked out of treatment and felt great. And, you know, unless you walk out of the door of the treatment facility, you're going to stay sober for as many days as you're in there. So I walked out with 25 days, you know, and never felt better. And came out, and that was a Tuesday that I got discharged, and started going to meetings in Kankakee on the next day. And, you know, it was wild because I walked into this Alano club where I've been going to meetings ever since. My very first night at this meeting, didn't know a soul. And I walked in and the place was completely packed. I mean, packed. And I thought, wow. And I walked to the back and I saw this woman. I said, I'm looking for the AA meeting. And she's like, you're at it, honey. And, you know, it turned out that it was packed because this guy was getting his 50-year coin. So here I walk in with 25 days sitting in the back of the room looking at this guy, you know, getting a 50-year coin. And as intimidating as it was also inspiring because I, you know, I looked around that room and all kinds of people were talking and I thought, wow, this is doable. You know, I mean, you know, you leave treatment and now you're in the outside world, but I knew that place held a lot of hope for me. And then, you know, 2 days later, I met with people at school and I found out that I was not getting my job back. And, you know, to be honest with you, Eric, I had never felt as relieved as I did because the stress of that job, you know, not to blame it, but just the stress of that job and me being an alcoholic were a bad combination. You know, I found myself drinking my problems away and stresses away and, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, to be honest with you, and I knew that I was in a different mindset at that point because when I walked out of that building that day, I didn't feel the predominant feeling that I felt was relief. Mm. You know, I was, okay, I'm out of a job and I need to find something, but I felt way better than I ever thought I should feel, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, going in treatment and, yeah, something else I learned in treatment that I think is, I try to share this on Twitter with people and, you know, we went to, you know, 27 meetings. We had AA meetings and we had NA meetings. We had open meetings. We had closed meetings. And I heard so many people talk. And you hear people who are very successful. You know, we used to go to a meeting on Monday nights. It was a men's only meeting at a church in Champaign. We got to leave the facility, which was cool, but you know, it was a men's meeting with a ton of high quality sobriety. And I would see guys getting 27, 28 year coins. And, you know, you listen to those guys talk about what helped them, how they've been successful. And then I would hear people talk about, you know, well, this is my third time in treatment. It's my fourth time in treatment. In fact, I was on my floor. I was with a guy. It was his eighth time in treatment and he was 30 years old. Hmm. And you hear people, you know, you hear people talk about why they weren't successful. And what I learned was the guys who were successful did things the way they were supposed to be done. You know, they went to meetings, they worked the steps, they had a sponsor, they had surrendered to their higher power, they had done all these things and they had never stopped. And the people that had struggled and had relapsed had always quit something. You know, they'd quit going to meetings, they'd quit talking to their sponsor. They were at step three for 4 years and never continued. And I just made my mind up. You know, I think this applies to any part of life. If you want to be as successful as somebody is in any given field, you do what they do. Hmm. And, you know, that's what I've done. I've, You know, I went to a meeting this morning. I told the group, I said, tomorrow is 120 days, and I've had 120 days of very high-quality sobriety. And I say that completely honestly, and it's I've never had an urge to drink a beer. I have, from the time I checked myself into treatment, I was done. You know, the thought goes through my mind of a beer, and I've been in bars two or three times since I've been out of treatment, but I've never, you know, I've never had a serious thought about drinking. And I think a part of that was, you know, I said this before in a lot of AA meetings, I think when I went to Rosecrans, I was exhausted. And I, you know, I don't mean physically exhausted. I mean, just, I was exhausted of being tired, exhausted of being hungover, exhausted of saying I'm sorry for something I did or said or, you know, didn't do or didn't say, or, you know, I was exhausted with the whole life of being an alcoholic. And once I found that there was peace and serenity in sobriety, it was a game changer for me. And, you know, I really think that I would have considered putting myself into treatment a long time ago had I thought that I could do it. Because, again, having always associated drinking with fun and being stress-free and having a great time, I just, when I thought about not drinking, I would think about, okay, if I go to a Cubs game, what am I going to do? How am I going to have fun? You know, if I go to a Bulls game or if I go to a concert, how am I, you know, because alcohol was, you know, you find a way to attach it to every part of your life when you're an alcoholic. And I really think that held me back from looking for help a long time ago. But, you know, everything happens for a reason when it happens. So, yeah, I found a good life. And, you know, it's funny that now fun to me is going to the club on a Tuesday morning at 9:30 and reading and studying the Big Book with three veteran sober guys that I called three wise men. You know, I mean, we read, we highlight, we discuss, and to me, that's fun. You know, I mean, or I'll read devotionals with a mug of tea here at my house. I've realized that sobriety is very, very cool, that, you know, I wouldn't trade it. But I do think that continuing to be around other alcoholics is critical for me. You know, even now that I'm not in treatment, I think, you know, there's something so powerful about being around people that are fighting your fight, because, you know, there's people in every alcoholic's life that'll look at him and say, why can't you stop drinking? You know, you can, why don't you? And they don't get it. They don't understand that we're wired differently. You know, it's an illness, and we didn't ask for it, but we got it. And, you know, I learned from reading the Big Book, it's no different than cancer. It's just looked at differently than cancer, because, you know, people look at alcoholics as sitting in bars and wasting money and acting like idiots. And, you know, but at the end of the day, it's an illness, just like cancer is. But, you know, I'm as many say, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And, you know, I keep doing the same things every day. I wake up first thing in the morning and I read my step three prayer, you know, that it's God's will today and not mine. And, you know, just again, that step three has been so big for me that I don't have to fight it anymore. I don't have to fight my will versus his. I don't have to, you know, he's got a plan for me, and I trust in that. And, you know, everything I've been through, you know, I've heard so many stories of people, once they give their life up to God, amazing things start happening. And, you know, there's a saying, before you're halfway through, you're going to be amazed. And I've been amazed. You know, I'm getting ready to do step seven now. And
awesome.
I just, you know, to him goes all the glory for my sobriety. It's not me, because I spent 38 years proving I couldn't do it on my own. You know, it's without him and his guidance and the support of the people that love me, which is amazing. And, you know, I just, like I said at this meeting this morning, all I try to do every day is surround myself with people who either support my recovery or they're people that I aspire to be like. You know, and I've had to cut some people out of my life, and that's okay, because, you know, you're taught in treatment that the hierarchy is God and then your sobriety and then you and then everything else. And I've really kept my sobriety at a very high level priority wise. It's, you know, I have to make it more important to me than my daughters or than Kathy, because it's just, you know, it can vanish in a heartbeat, and I don't want that to happen. So, Yeah, I feel great. You know, I'm 55 years old. I've never felt better in my entire life. And that's, you know, through the grace of God and the fellowship of AA right there. I'm a poster child for that. So that is my story.
Awesome. That was great. I have a few questions for you. So, let's see. So a lot of it's probably going to be, so I guess the first question is, you know, it took you a little while to get to recovery, right? And I'm curious that you said your father was in the rooms. Now, did the fact that your father participated in AA affect your ability to admit to yourself first, like A, to admit to yourself that you might have a problem, and B, to kind of follow in his footsteps to the fellowship?
That's a really good question. I honestly, I don't think that his experience in those rooms helped me admit that I had a problem. Because I think, you know, I think every alcoholic hits their own rock bottom. And, you know, honestly, it drove my mom nuts that I enjoyed drinking beer as much as I did, having gone through what I did. You know, she is deceased now, but it caused her a lot of heartache that, you know, I enjoyed drinking as much as I did, given the pain that it caused in my life through him. But, you know, I think every alcoholic goes through their own paces, excuse me, in identifying and coming to grips with the fact that they are. And I will say that I think him going through the program helped me once I got into the program.
Yeah.
You know, and looking back, you know, and seeing that, you know, I wrote this to somebody the other day that, you know, I'm more amazed now, having gone through what I've gone through, about his recovery than I used to be, because I know how difficult it is. But I think, you know, I don't think it helped me identify myself as an alcoholic, that I needed help. But I do think that it helped me buy into the program more, probably, that he went through it than if he had not. Because I, you know, again, I don't remember a lot of the details, but, you know, I don't recall him talking a lot about meeting. I mean, I know he was going. And the fact that, you know, he was able to stay sober as a result of that, I think it empowered me once I knew that, you know, again, that coupled with hearing successful people, you know, through my own experience, I knew that AA was the only way to go. And, you know, going through treatment, being with 15 other guys constantly, except when you're in the bathroom, you know, you hear a lot of guys coming up with their own plans. I mean, I would hear guys say, well, I'm not going to go to meetings, and I'm not going to go get a sponsor, and I'm not going to work. You know, I'm not saying you can't be sober that way, but I guess my question was, why would you reinvent the wheel? You know, I mean, again, hearing all the guys talk that had been so successful, I thought, why would you do anything different than that? So that's all I've tried to emulate. But yeah, I think, yes, again, that's a really good question. I think it just empowered my mind as the strength of the program, knowing that he had gone through it and stayed sober more than I had to find my own way as an alcoholic. I mean, I think I knew for a while, but again, until your butt is sliding along the asphalt or rock bottom on your own, you don't necessarily wrap your arms around it. So.
And just to stick with your father for a moment, and mainly fatherhood in general. Now, you said you grew up in kind of a dysfunctional household with your father being an alcoholic. And I was curious, because I've asked people about this before, and you're a father of two. So did you take any lessons that were learned from your childhood and try not to, you know, apply the same type of, I guess, the same type of things your father did? Because since you were drinking, like, 100%. Did you try, like, and I guess, how successful were you in that? Because, I mean, if alcoholism was active, it might have been hard, right?
No, that's another great question. You're on a roll here, pal. You know, at a very young age, I made up my mind, made the decision that I was never going to be the father that he was. And, you know, I mean, I think if we had another hour, we could go through my dad's childhood, because he grew up in a household where "I love you" was very rarely said. There was not a lot of affection, and, you know, he had a lot of responsibility on him as a kid as well, in a different way, you know, living on a farm, having to work all the time, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, there were two nights I can remember specifically in my childhood where I was sitting on the couch waiting for him to get home because I was going to kill him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a rolling pin in my hand one time. I was probably 10 or 11 years old, and I didn't know how I was going to get it done, but I had had enough of what was going on in my family and watching my brother and mom suffer.
Yeah.
And when you go through those things, you know, I had made up my mind that, you know, when I became a father, I was not going to be that way. And I wasn't. You know, I mean, my relationship with my two daughters is extraordinary. Always, even when I was drinking, it was. I mean, we've always been very, very tight. You know, obviously going through the divorce, we went through some rough patches, particularly with my youngest, but... you know, and they were probably privy to some arguments with my ex-wife at that time that they overheard, or, you know, but I loved them. You know, I was at every event they were ever participating in. I told them I loved them as much as I could tell them. I mean, they grew up in a very loving household. And if they were on this call, they'd tell you the same thing. So I, you know, but then again, in a way, I failed. You know, when I was in treatment, I looked back and, you know, you realize that I had become, you know, at least in the drinking way, very much like him. Mm. And that was uncomfortable because, you know, again, the last 15 years of my dad's life, we had a great relationship. And I don't want to make it sound like, you know, it was always resentful and hateful and those things, because it wasn't. But, you know, it did make me uncomfortable that I had become the monster, so to speak, you know, the monster that dominated my childhood. You know, I didn't physically abuse my wife at the time, but we had some intense arguments, and, you know, when I was drunk, and I think there was emotional abuse there. There was some mental abuse unintentionally. So, you know, I guess to answer your question, in a lot of ways, I was not what he was. But in some ways I was, you know, and again, I feel like, you know, I think any parent wants their kid to have a better life than they had. And I feel 100% committed to the fact that my two daughters did have much better childhoods than I did, you know, and that's what I wanted. Yeah. And they're fantastic human beings today. And then they're going to change people's lives, and, you know, they're good. And they're 100% supportive of my recovery. You know, they've been very proud of me since I put myself into treatment. You know, and I'm not sure they know the exact details of my childhood, but they know that things went on that were left of center. And, you know, again, they're tomorrow, I'll get texts from both of them. They keep track of my sober days on their own. And, you know, they're proud of me. And that's, you know, that makes it very much worthwhile.
Awesome. So you mentioned it during your answer there, but you mentioned your divorce, and, you know, I guess kind of sticking with the whole theme, where how much, and, you know, obviously, like, relationships kind of have their own life cycle, but how much do you believe that your alcoholism played a role in your divorce?
You know, I think in retrospect, a lot. You know, it distanced us. Mm. You know, I mean, my wife was a very highly committed kindergarten teacher, and it, for the most part, the latter 4, 5, 6 years that we were married, I was an athletics director. We were both working 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and... You know, our good energy was spent on our jobs and our kids. And, you know, I think we grew apart. And I think, you know, one of the things I don't miss about having an alcoholic brain is the resentments that I carried. Mm. And, you know, throughout the time that I was an alcoholic, an active alcoholic, I was a very resentful person. You know, I was a poor communicator, and I was resentful, which is a bad parlay. And when we couldn't, you know, if my wife was spending a weekend in the classroom, which she did frequently, and that was frustrating to me, I drank. Well, you know, let me drink about that, and I'll get back to you. You know, So I think, you know, the times when I obviously overdid it were rough. But, you know, it's the mentality, you know, that I'll use beer to get through this frustration, or we just had an argument, I'll have beer to get through it. And, you know, it did nothing to help. You know, I'll say that quite openly. But again, that's, you know, she suggested to me, well, several would be an understatement, during our marriage that I needed some help. Not just, I mean, I don't think it was just in terms of the alcohol, but just knowing my childhood, because I never did get therapy for it, ever. Mm. You know, for what I went through, and never really knew, you know, I didn't grow up being taught how to handle frustration and how to handle stress, and this is what you do to get through this problem. And, you know, I mean, I kept, throughout my youth, I kept it all inside. I didn't deal with it. I just packed it away. Yeah. And, you know, then we start drinking, stuff comes out. So, you know, I think it had a lot to do with that. You know, I regret that. Obviously, there's nothing I can do to change it. My ex-wife and I have a good relationship. She's proud of, you know, where I'm at now as well. But, you know, everything happens for a reason. You know, I used to believe in coincidences until I turned my life over to God. Now I don't think there are any coincidences. So I think all these things happen. You know, I had to go through all these things to get to the point where I knew that I had a problem. And, you know, it's all for a reason. It's all part of the plan. And, you know, again, there's a lot of things that I regret, like any alcoholic regrets. We talk about them all the time in AA meetings. You know, you look back, but you can't change them. Mm. You know, when I get to steps 8 and 9, I'll make amends for them. But, you know, and it's been a conscious thing that I've done, is for me to recover, I can't dwell in the past. I could. I have every opportunity and every reason to, but it, you know, one of the things that's been very successful for me in my recovery is living in the moment. And, you know, I had experienced mindfulness a little bit on my own prior to treatment, but when I went to Rosecrans, we were taught mindfulness. We had classes on mindfulness. And, you know, my alcoholic mind would always wander. It would get tied up in resentments and angers. And, you know, it was amazing sometimes, thinking back when I was drinking, where my resentful mind could take me. I could eat up 2 or 3 hours thinking of, you know, plans of revenge on somebody who had made me mad. I mean, I think about all the time and energy I wasted in that mindset. And now, you know, every day I practice mindfulness, and somebody told me once, wherever your feet are at, that's where your head's at. And I've not forgotten that. And, you know, if I'm in a meeting, I'm 100% focused on that AA meeting. If I'm working, I'm 100% focused on working. I don't, you know, I have much better control of my thoughts right now. And we can't control the thoughts we have, but we can control the ones we react to. And I'm so much better at that now today than I was 4 or 5 months ago. You know, but again, to answer your question, yeah, I think my alcoholism had a lot to do with the downfall of my marriage. But, you know, that's water under the bridge. Sounds like I'm minimizing it, and I'm not, but there's really not much I can do. You know, even after the divorce, my ex-wife and I agreed that we were going to work together to be the best parents of our kids separately as we could be, and we've done that. You know, our two daughters have always been our priority, and, you know, they're my pride and joy, and again, they're amazing people, and I think it's very cool as a dad to look at both your daughters as role models, you know, even as much younger as they are than I am, you know, but they are, and we've done, my ex-wife and I have done a great job raising two beautiful human beings, and, you know, I'm digressing, but, you know, we've worked through that divorce, and, you know, everybody's in a much, it's obviously terrible, and it could have been worse. Well, I guess it couldn't have been worse than it was for us, but, you know, we're all in a better place now, and we're okay, and, you know, working through it together.
Awesome. So this is the last question, just a fun question. You mentioned having fun in recovery, and I really enjoy reading recovery literature. It is one of probably my favorite things to do. Just any fellowship, any book, I don't really care. But what besides that do you enjoy doing for fun now that you're sober?
Oh, I love going to AA meetings. I'm serious. What I appreciate about going to AA meetings are a couple of things. Number one is I've always gone to them because I've wanted to, mm-hmm. not that I've needed to. You know, I made my 90 meetings in 90 days. Again, I heard that a lot of times that was part of success. So I did that. But I never went to one where I felt like I absolutely needed to. And I've seen people that have been there because they needed to. You know, it's so fun to me is going to an AA meeting and developing relationships. And I said this at a meeting this morning. I think I enjoy being around alcoholics because I think people who have gone through struggles in their life have a deeper appreciation of what the good life is when they find it.
Yeah.
You know, and again, I've been through a lot of traumas, and now that I've found the good life, I enjoy hearing people's stories. You know, I mean, if you and I were to sit down and you tell me your story, even if it's not like mine, I would enjoy hearing your story because I'm fascinated by people's stories, you know, and the things that contribute to them being the people they are. I'm a people person. I've always been a people person. I care about people. I think it's fun to go to meetings. You know, I enjoy being with Kathy when she gets home from work. I'm working from home now, doing a couple different things. I've really dedicated the rest of my life is going to be dedicated to helping people. I started a travel agency because I enjoy, you know, helping people's travel dreams come true. But I've started working with a company called Worldwide Health Solutions, which I'm unbelievably passionate about. It's brain technology. It's socks, it's a sleeve, it's inserts for your shoes, and it increases the capacity of your brain by 30 to 40% instantly. And I'm wearing a sleeve as I'm speaking to you right now, and I've never felt better in my life. And the people that I'm exposing to this have never felt better in their life. So that's fun to me. Helping people is fun to me. So I loved working on that every day at my computer here in my office in my house. You know, I just love trying to get the word out about how life-changing this technology is. And I don't know. I enjoy being with my kids. I enjoy being with people I love. I think that's fun. Kathy and I enjoy going to movies. We enjoy going for walks. We enjoy going, you know, on vacation. To me, Eric, it's fun to wake up tomorrow, you know, put my head on my pillow tonight sober by the grace of God, wake up tomorrow and, you know, be clear-minded and productive, and that's fun to me. You know, it's just wild how, you know, I'm about 179 degrees away from where I was 4 months ago, and it's just fun to be clear-headed and sober. You know, whatever I do during the day is fun. And, I've met a lot of people in recovery who want to speed things up. They want to get 10 years of sobriety. They want to get 20. I'm not like that. You know, I enjoy every day. That doesn't mean the Skittles are falling from the sky every day. I mean, I still have things that I'm dealing with and whatever, but I'm just slow rolling it. You know, I just, you know, every phone call I have with a friend, every text, conversation I'm having, I'm just enjoying every minute of my life right now. And it's a feeling that I've never had in my life. You know, it took me 55 years to get to this point, but I'm here and, you know, I'm loving it. And I use the word slow rolling a lot, but again, to answer your question, I have fun doing anything now. It's just being an alcoholic is very heavy. And, you know, it's just nice. In fact, I'll give you an example. I was sitting at my desk yesterday working, and my desk faces this very, very large picture window out of the front of my house. In this city cop car pulled up in front of my driveway yesterday. It didn't pull in, but just pulled up in front and continued to go by my house very, very slowly. I thought, wow, this is weird. And I thought, what did I do last night? And it was, I laughed at myself that, you know, it's just nice not to, you know, wake up and like, what did I do last night? What did I say? What to who? What did I, how did I make an ass of myself? You know what I mean? It's just like 800 pounds off my soul being sober in so many different ways. So being sober is fun, and everything else that comes with it, I'm just enjoying every single minute of, you know, I enjoy every day, whether it's got good things, bad things, whatever. It's, you know, it's because I'm clean, and I know that I can handle whatever comes at me clean. I don't have to drink to get through anything, because, you know, that's probably the biggest lesson I've learned is, you know, I was drinking to run from things, but as I was running, those things were running right behind me. You know, yeah. I was just kicking the can down the road for another day by trying to get away from stuff. And, you know, I realized that God made me the way he wanted me to be. He just didn't want me to be drunk. And he gave me all the tools that I need to get through everything I'm going to face in my life. And, you know, being able to do that is fun. You know, it's, so yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. I hope it does, but.
Definitely. Yeah.
Every waking minute is fun to me right now, just because I don't have to rely on anything. I can be me. I can be real and, you know, and be sober. So, yeah, it's, I don't know. I want to help other alcoholics. And if people listen to this at some point and get something out of what I said, I hope it helps them, because, you know, all of our stories are the same in a lot of ways, and we can all find peace and serenity and happiness. You just got to make your mind up that you can do it, and if you want it bad enough, you know. It's like we read in How It Works, you know, if you want what we have, then these are the steps you got to follow. I want what all these guys have, and, you know, I'm in AA with a lot of people that don't have hardly any money, and they don't have this and they don't have that, but they're as happy as they can be, and that's inspiring to me. You know, you just find out what true happiness really means, and it's not stuff. You know, it's not cars, it's not houses, it's none of that stuff. It's love and relationships for me. That's what makes me happy. So that makes me happy every day.
Awesome. Well, we are about out of time, but I would like to thank you for coming on. It was a great story.
My pleasure. I'm glad to do it, and was honored to be invited. So thank you very much for that.
Cool. So... I do not have the rundown. That is David's usual thing. But guys, if you can follow us on any of our platforms, Twitter, YouTube, follow our podcast, rate, review, follow us on Instagram. We have a Patreon now that you can go to, you know, just anything that you guys want to do to follow us and support us. We are always appreciative. But most importantly, stay safe and stay clean.